This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this month we can safely say spring has sprung, because I'm back on the antihistamines, because the sinuses are reacting to all that damn pollen.
I'm making the most of it until I get the late onset hay fever the way everybody else seems to be.
Really? Oh, well, I'm already heading in that direction. And we're here this month to talk about social structures and whether they are a good thing to have or whether it should just be for murder hobos.
Dunny, nunny, or civilised rules, copper.
Bang. Bang, bang. And also, we'll be talking about how often do you do this? Perhaps we should have a survey. How often do people do this? How often do you get together with your friends and do role-playing games? So we should remember to include in the survey people who really want to, but don't anymore.
I will stick a poll on the release thread for this if I remember.
Yeah, see, we are now relying on Roger's memory. That's a terrifying thing. Let's get on to the discussion.
Socially grounded player characters. Is this a good thing? Should you do it? Do you do it? How do you do it?
Hey, hang on a second. Can I get a definition of terms here?
Well, I think this was a suggestion from valued listener Shim, but I appear to have lost his original text. As far as I'm concerned, it is the character who is part of a functioning society.
Ooh. Yeah, as a place to go and where they have to let him in.
Now, that may or may not be where the adventuring is happening.
Yeah.
But that's a separate thing, but at least they're part of. Now, looking at the history of gaming, as I tend to, the D&D war game basically doesn't do this. By which I mean the thing that started as a war game and then turned into the dungeon bashing game.
Then turned into a lot of other things.
You have your combatants, you send them down into the fight. And anything more than the tactical situation, you can retreat and go back to town, but town is essentially abstract. There are no rules for it. There aren't even rules for cross-country travel until later editions. You pay this much for healing, you pay that much to train to go up a level, that kind of thing.
Yeah, purely transactional, purely an emotional thing, which couldn't last and didn't last. We've said before, and I'll say it again because I like the sound of my own voice, the ethos of the early D&D and still of a lot of role-playing games is the Old West, is the band of good people going out, or at least capable people, going out and solving problems out in the wilderness and returning to town, as you say, for resupply, healing up, and training. And the town itself is going to be a border town without much in the way of social complexity, possibly not even a church that they can attend on a Sunday.
So, well, it's got to have somewhere to get healed, though.
Well, yes, that's true, but... But the
church of "we don't ask questions, we'll gaffer tape your arm back on again."
The church of Saint Impecunious, who is grateful for any donations and doesn't ask who you took it off.
But I think the Western model has an answer to this, because one of the Western tropes is, I am the toughest guy in town, I can take whatever I want. But the Western tropes make it clear that that is not a good person.
True.
And I've certainly heard of people in the early days essentially realising, that our characters are much harder and better at fighting than any plausible town guard.
Yeah.
So we can just take what we want. And the answer to that, I think, is... The traditional answer was, make a tougher town guard then. The sheriff is the toughest guy in town, which is sadly historically accurate for at least some of this period. But to me, the more interesting model is the social one. I don't want to be an outlaw.
No.
I don't want to have every man's hand against me. You know, I want floozies and soft toilet paper and other things that I cannot guess just by stealing.
The orcs don't use toilet paper. Leaves are the very couthiest of them.
Of rocks. Pointy rocks.
No, that's the dwarves.
And also, there are scary things out there. And you know who said Bear is brotherless back? Grettir the Strong. If he said it, you should believe it. Once you're an outlaw, you've got to look at all your mates are wondering whether they can turn you in for the reward.
True. And that is going to be the answer to the thief player who is robbing his comrades, because it's just what my character would do, is that your comrades are going to notice it eventually, and they're going to hand you over to somebody who will take care of the little problem. If they don't want to take care of it themselves, and frag you out in the middle of nowhere, where it's so much easier to dispose of the bodies.
Very dangerous down in the dungeon. Never know where the next arrow might come from, sir.
That one of the things about the trope of this being basically a Western is that the Western was a limited period of time.
Yeah.
It was on the borders of an expanding industrial civilization, where there were people who were disputing the holding of the land and people who wanted to get away from all that law and order. But the railroad was coming into town eventually. The territory would become a state eventually. And this is just a small period of time where the war-weary remnants of a dreadful civil war are using the skills they know best in a manner that wouldn't be tolerated back east.
Yeah, and I think some of the better Westerns are aware that this is an evolving process. You know, within your few years of living in the frontier town, it can go from we are taking the land off the natives to this is now a settled farming country, and you can't do that stuff anymore.
And in the thought of it would be wrong because you are breaking your word to the natives, it never seems to come up for some reason. And I think the same thing could have been written into the earlier D&D. In fact, I got the strong feeling it probably was in places that the king is going to have a look at. The king is sending somebody to have a look at his newly acquired territory, and there's going to be a sheriff and tax collectors and somebody's going to get knighted and is going to look down his nose at the rest of you. It might as well be one of you. One of the goals of D&D was to age out of being an adventurer, becoming a baron or a high wizard or something.
Yeah, this is a thing that I remember reading about in the books, but I never met it in play, possibly because the games I was involved in didn't last long enough.
Yeah, and possibly because they stuck other levels on top of the 10 levels of the original edition. Yeah. So you could go and get on getting mightier until you blew up from the pure strain and awesomeness of being you.
The curvature of space has a limit, and your personal gravity has exceeded it. Congratulations, you are now a black hole. But also, the king may well say, hang on a minute, I hear stories from over there on the frontier that these guys are bringing out tens of thousands of gold pieces. And I feel that they should be contributing to the support of the kingdom.
Yeah, that, as I mentioned, the tax collector comes in just after the sheriff arrives. Sometimes the sheriff is the tax collector.
But we're still talking about games on the fringes of society, and honestly, I find games that are in society more interesting. In part because there are increasing numbers of problems that you cannot solve just by being more violent than the other guy. And even in the Western tropes, we have this. You know, there is the rich, evil landowner. And you can't just shoot him, because the sheriff is going to be on his side until his evilness is proved.
Yeah. And yes, I think when you move to games set in a particular set of societies, you have two problems. One is that there is just too much hierarchy and too much and too much people allowed to tell you what to do for the temperament of some people. Well, as some people and a lot of role players. And fun is fun, and playing your part within the hierarchy and doing things for the hierarchy. One of the first role-playing games was En Garde, which, even if it was only a stupid thing that they used to play, Games Workshop used to play, Games Workshop.
Games Designers Workshop in the very early days.
Put together to play on a Friday night. Nonetheless, you were, the sort of things you were doing were things within a society, a society with a greasy pole. And the feature of the game was you could climb the greasy pole and you get to be a noble, even if you started out as the bastard son of a peasant.
And thinking of the... Okay, I'm not going to claim anything about first games because that's a snake bit. But looking at Traveller and RuneQuest, the Third Imperium and Glorantha. Okay, the Third Imperium kind of grows on later, but Glorantha is part of RuneQuest right from the start.
Yeah.
And both of those have that this option. You know, you can go to a place where nobody's going to tell you what to do, and you beat up monsters. But there is also the society you come from, and part of the game is going to be involve being somebody in that, maybe climbing it, maybe not.
Yeah. All right. Well, Glorantha brings up a point I was about to make, which is for there to be great adventure, you need the society, however stable, to be under some sort of stress. And in Glorantha, both the Lunar Empire, because they're the ones going to the fringes of forever and dealing with the barbarians out there, and the Sartorites and Praxians and the rest of them, are the barbarians that are being put down and are being oppressed quite heavily. And so there is conflict there, and the situation isn't stable. So you have a society which has a lot of ways of doing things, both the Storm Worshippers and the Moon Worshippers have huge amounts of cultural baggage coming with them. But those ways of doing things on both sides aren't working very well anymore. And there's going to be this clash between them, and you're going to have some sort of breakdown in society, but it's a more subtle, more nuanced breakdown in the order of you get told what to do and you do it.
And I think the default RuneQuest setup is generally tribal, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yes, you have superiors, but it's not a big, complicated, multi-level thing. There is the boss of your tribe. There is the high priest of your tribe.
On a technical nitpicking moment, you probably start out with your clan, which is part of a tribe, which was part of a kingdom, and the kingdom is now broken. That was the setup, and getting to speak to your tribal chief is an honour few people look towards, though they tend to be rude and contemptuous of authority when they do get to speak to them. I don't know why. Perhaps because they were role players.
Hey, though looking at the Third Imperium, that does not have civilizational stresses on it, I think.
No, but
prior to the whole Civil War thing, obviously. And the Jordani are out there and they're going to invade someday. There are these minor things, but they're things that can cause threats. There are things that those in power will be very unhappy about. There are things that will possibly cause a lot of people to die, but there is very little that says the actual Imperium might stop.
No, there are... Most of the games are set on borders. On the land where it stops being the Third Imperium. There are a few scattered semi-independent states, and then there's the Zordani or some other power, and that makes the driver for the little local problems. To quote, I think it was it a Tory or a Labour politician at one stage, that are actually having to be dealt with right now.
But also small stakes are big stakes to the people involved. You know, to the Imperium, this planet developing a dictatorship, well, we don't really care about that as long as they keep paying their taxes to us. To the people on the planet, it matters.
Yeah. And probably somewhere there is some obscure imperial covert action group, which is either keeping an eye on it, encouraging the trend towards dictatorship, or subtly undermining it. Because that's something they're not supposed to do. They're supposed to respect the powers of the individual planets and not interfere outside the remit necessary to keep the ships coming.
A friend of the show, Brett Evel, has taken this even further in his Flat Black setting, where there is a very strict, I think it is the Kármán line, below which the planet has jurisdiction. Basically, they don't get to have starships. They don't really get to have spaceships.
Hmm.
The Empire deals with that. The Empire is not nice, but the Empire will give them absolute freedom as long as they keep to those rules and a very small number of others.
Hmm.
And so what the PCs end up doing is working for a charity or a concerned organisation, or very occasionally an unofficial branch of the Empire, to go and solve the problem.
Okay, I think we've drifted a little far, but I am going to stick to my point that you need some sort of credible threat, something that allows the player characters to be brave or wise or just something to be impressive and to have a story to tell at the end of the day.
Yep. I don't think, if it has existed, I don't think it's been more than a niche game. I don't think it's been a successful one that was basically real world without any special powers. I do count espionage in the James Bond style as special powers here.
Yeah. Well, there are games in which all you're concerned with is romance, but they tend to be set in historical periods and therefore are slightly strange in themselves. There have been games set in the swashbuckling period,
which true.
Don't really... The musketeers and privateers and that sort of person don't, technically speaking, have special powers.
They are a long way from our lived experience, but yes, I'll grant it.
Mm. So, yeah, the problems you have with settings where the player characters are part of a society come in two forms, I think. People who want to be part of the society a little too much, and people who don't have any respect for the structures of the society and the bringing the ways of the frontier, the ways of the Wild West, and in with them. When they say, yes, I'll be happy to play his manservant. And we will pause here to note something we've already noted several times, that British players tend to assume that being the subordinate and screwing up your superior is more fun than being the superior.
Yeah, and this certainly can verge into problem player behaviour. It's a pulp trope, you know, the half savage manservant of the big hero whose life he saved, and so he's loyal unto death and whatever. But yeah, that does not mean he gets to run wild at the dinner party.
You will notice that wise manservant in my Lunar campaign was an NPC and a barbarian and a slave, and still managed to look down upon his master. The person who gets really into the social structure and likes the social structure can be a bit creepy. But on the whole, a player who's willing to play this well and to realise that he's going to be the one negotiating with higher authorities on behalf of the party, and he's the one who's going to be held responsible, but he's also the one who might get to marry the senator's daughter. is going
to marry the senator's daughter?
No. The chances, this is a highly sophisticated society, and the chances of the senator's daughter getting knocked up is fairly minimal. Also, she'd probably have you assassinated if she took it wrong.
As I see it, the problems are either that a society makes it too easy or that a society makes it too hard. The too easy is the horror film problem. You know, why don't they call for help? Why don't they just tell the police about this obviously illegal thing going on?
Hmm.
And there are solutions to this, but they are solutions one has to think about.
Yeah.
And too hard is, well, yeah, if I go round breaking into people's houses at dead of night and sometimes setting them on fire, the police are going to take an interest in me.
So you hear, yes, this is why you want to be recruited by the shadowy organisation that will cover up all your misdeeds.
That's certainly one of the answers. One of my answers for why don't we tell the cops is often because the cops will be fed to the monster and come out as a chunky policeman kibble, and it won't really help anything, and it'll get them killed.
Yeah. And if as I think I've said this before, and if the chief constable gets turned into a minion, he's just going to add to your problem.
He's already a Freemason. Let's stick at that. Yeah.
I think one of the problems of living within a socially structured society is that there are a lot of rules and there's a lot of customs and there's a lot of savoir-faire to be followed. And the player who'll take a real interest in that is going to be a rare person. I suspect it's most, actually, from my small experience, I suspect it's mostly female characters who want to get the social ranking things right. No, you don't address her as your grace. You address her as your serenity, that sort of thing. And insisting on their own status and trying to get the wild hooligans who seem to miraculously cluster around them into some sort of order. That can be fun and it can be obnoxious. If I do a new Ars Magica campaign, that may come up. Because we have people whose job it is to go and talk to the local authorities about the basically illegal and possibly blasphemous things that are happening up in the Wizard's Tower and convince them to be happy about this.
Keyboard, it was those other wizards over there what done it.
Often it is, yes. No. they were coming in and poaching our wheat. Or what is wheat? What is this thing? You're harvesting it? I am owed 10% of that, says the bishop.
Okay, but you're not going to like the bit where your eyes start glowing.
Maybe he will. I mean, it's very good for faking miracles, Weez.
It's tricky. I will readily admit that this is harder than just saying there are some guys over there you've got to go and kill. But I find it much more satisfying.
Sure.
I grant I have more of a taste perhaps for soap opera than most of my fellow players. I'm not specifying GMs versus non-GMs here.
Hmm.
I want to chat with that bloke who cleans the slime off our armour after each mission. I want to, we probably hang out at a pub after hours and I want to find out who the other people who hang out at that pub are and maybe make friends with some of them, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
But that's me.
Well, my current campaign is set in two current campaigns is set in a fantasy city of my unique design, and the player characters are wizards, trainee wizards, junior magic students, first years at the city's Institute for Magic, and because their training is going very, very slowly. And they're really not supposed to use magic outside the classroom as much as they are. They always have an excuse and they always fill in the reports. And the authorities so far have always said, well, I suppose so. But because they are doing these routine things under other people's instructions, much of the focus of it is soap opera. And it's one of the characters had an unknown enemy whose identity has now been sorted out. And they managed to bring his clone brothers back from the other world where they would be kept. And they now have three frozen clones of him with no education and no previous experience.
Yeah.
And one who has just been introduced to the idea of putting trousers on. So that's a lot of soap opera in the background as they try and manage how they're going to get through his sister's wedding is going to be deeply beyond me.
I know people who would run this in Monster Hearts or Good Society, certainly.
Well, the Good Society, yes, bits of Good Society ideas will have to come up and be subsumed into this basic GURPS campaign. I think it's quite interesting. The only I think it's quite workable. I think the only problem with it is giving equal time to the five players to do the things they're obsessed with before going off and doing group things and going to parties and things like that.
Mm.
So it eventually is going to turn into a great social movement campaign happening in the background as the gods of the city fight the government of the city.
Yeah.
But that's, though they are peripherally involved, that's not their central concern. Their central concern is doing their classes, exploiting the extra education opportunities, and, you know, surviving the generalised shit that life throws at you.
Not getting caught climbing back into college after hours.
Oh, no, there's none of that. If you can fly, it's dead easy.
That's cheating.
It's cheating if you don't have a licence.
So my answer to all this is, yes, this is absolutely what I want out of a game, much more than the fighting is.
Well, I think doing the exciting things is what you have to work around the soap opera.
Well, I'd like to have both.
And you have to work the soap opera around doing the exciting things. Yeah, there are. I think I said this about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, both the TV series and the role playing game. It thrives upon several strands, which are comedy, soap opera, action adventure, because you want to see Buffy do her high kicks and you want to see the great horrible monster of the week get destroyed somehow, and the third thing is nerdy stuff, because this is about the nerdy stuff is about the exciting, interesting little details of the setting and discovering all sorts of background stuff that the scriptwriters may not want to explore, but being nerds, we find fascinating, and we will probably write fanfic about.
I seem to recall Jane Espenson said, oh yeah, we all wrote Buffy fanfic. We just called it season 6. I think some of the comedy comes from the deliberate disjunction. You know, I have just dragged myself back, covered in grot from killing a vampire that would have murdered people all over town. But I've still got that big test tomorrow, and I got to explain to my mum why I was out late. That is comedy as well as soap opera,
and the comedy is also the clash of basically teenagers trying to handle things which aged wizards cower before, and doing so with a certain amount of self-deprecation, which isn't really American, but you know. Okay.
What one of the strands I have met in magical school fan fiction is where the pupils realise, hang on a minute, these grown-ups who are supposed to be, you know, have a duty of care towards us are doing a really terrible job.
I have a whole rant, which I'm not going to hear, about why does everybody hate Dumbledore? He's doing his best. there is this subconscious assumption that the adults are responsible and ought to be capable, but often they're only one of the two. Since the headmaster in my primary school gave me a caning, basically to sustain his own authority and not to do me any good at all, I have been somewhat cynical about the abilities and motives of those in charge. And... I also look at I look at our current prime minister, and I think, well, yeah, he may be devoid of all charisma. In fact, he may be a charisma sink, a void into which charisma is sucked. But he's doing his best.
Ah, that's David Caruso.
Who's David Caruso? Oh, he's
CSI Miami guy. Also, other things, presumably. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got that job.
Presumably, I never was into the CSI series. CSI scenes on American television, and I assume British television as well, are ridiculously fast and forthcoming.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, but it's quite interesting as a study of how to build mystery games. I've talked about that before, and I will again, but now is possibly not the time. I'm going to keep doing this. It is more complex. Sometimes it means the trying to remember who is involved and what directions they're pulling in. You know, that we've got 16 factions, and each of those has people who are trying to get ahead in that faction and or betray it.
Well, that is why we look kindly upon the players who take notes, and that is why I record every session. Even if it's only going to get written up months and months later.
Also, we have Groff Viz for doing the relationship graphs.
That's nice. I mean, I've never actually done a full Smallville style relationship graph because I don't think I introduced that many elements. And I frequently forget some of the elements that I have introduced. And people say, Michael, that's not what you said the last time. And I go, oh, not again. Still, it's grand work if you can manage it,
and so badly paid.
You have the great gratitude and love of a small group of people, and sometimes their respect, but not always both together. Onward. The both of us, about our various ongoing games and the plans we have for the future and the plans we have. And I have talked in a somewhat smug fashion about the fact that I have two weekly groups which meet whenever our aged bodies and complicated social lives don't prevent us, on a Monday or a Wednesday every week, and have gone going back for decades. There's a different feel between the dynamic of a weekly game, and I think there's difference both for the GM and for the players, and a game which is once a month or so. I also have a knowledge of one game, at least I assume it's a continuous game, that has been playing at StabCon every 6 months since forever. It's a D&D-ish sort of game, may actually be real D&D of some variation, which people have been playing, and playing at an absurdly high level since forever. And I can't quite conceive of what something like that must be like. So, Roger, do you find there's a difference between the monthly game you're running for us at this moment and the weekly games? You have weekly games, I'm sure you've said.
Yeah. Also, the Cambridge group has a long established bi-weekly schedule. Basically, we have two games on the go at a time.
And that's a very healthy way to do it.
Well, yeah. And so the first thing is, do you have time to do the preparation? And the answer is no, because if you're me, you always do nothing until the day before anyway, no matter when the day before is.
Yeah.
So in theory, you might have more time. Weekly, I think more stuff sticks in the mind.
True.
Some of this obviously depends on how busy people's lives are in other respects, but I think most of us are fairly busy these days with one thing or another. And with Watson Hall, we have one player. Those are weekly games, though they might be in tranches. Mask of Nyarlathotep, for example, I think we did a total of 60-odd sessions but they were in six separate tranches, which are more or less the geographical areas, and we had pauses for other games in between.
That is a very healthy way of doing it. My groups tend to be me doing things for a while, and then when it comes to a climax or a convincing endpoint, then I try to shame one of the others into doing something. It works sometimes.
Warts and All has tended mostly towards shorter games, though we do have the occasional longer ones, and we will play, for example, the demo adventure that comes with a particular game system to see if we like the system. That's what I'm currently doing, running Outgunned. And the answer is, I quite like the system now that I've got the hang of it, but I'm not at all impressed with the adventure. But, yeah, so it goes.
Yeah.
We did try alternating weeks, but we were finding it was too much work. Just we're already tend to forget quite a lot about what happened, except for the one player who takes notes, and sometimes he's not there. So, yeah. so at the moment we're sticking with the series of weekly sessions for a particular thing. And I will certainly agree for the monthly stuff, whether or not I was running it, it tended to be quite hard work to get back into the frame. A thing I've taken to doing with Watson Hall is listening to the last 10 minutes of the recording the day before or earlier in the day of the next session.
Yeah, that is sensible.
Because even if we didn't mention the specific ongoing things, that will at least put me back in the frame of mind that I can remember roughly the sort of thing that we were dealing with.
And they will sometimes look at you and say, well, for next time, we would like to know. And I say, of course, it'll be perfectly straightforward, lying through my teeth. So, yeah, I find when I'm a player, I'm a lot lazier than I am as a GM. I suppose that follows necessarily. But I'm shamed by the fact that when I'm GMing, my players are often very productive between sessions. Not only the notes taker, but people who will take the stuff that I have put together and take the maps and make better versions of them, or start writing up questions which they think ought to be answered. And sometimes that means I discover that they've been assuming things which I thought I hadn't said, which is always a good thing to be notified of if it's going to happen.
Ideally before it really matters.
I'm not sure I could run something with a really long time tick on it. Half a year, a year, even three, even a quarterly game would be something I'd have to take copious notes of, do a proper write-up of every damn time, and struggle to get things. On the other hand, it would have a vastness of scale and a possibility of doing things offline that bring things up to date that I could possibly use to expand the world and the adventures in it into greater detail and depth. But I'm not really tempted, honestly.
The impression I get from hearing about the periodic D&D games at Stabcon is that it's not so much that there is a whole lot of ongoing complication as that there is an awful lot of backstory and lore and things that have happened before. The individual adventure may be a relatively straightforward mystery or whatever.
But somebody has brought out the sword they got from the tomb of what's-his-name.
And the players are all at least roughly aware of that whole deep background because they were there for it. I'm remembering during my World War II game, one of the players became too ill to continue playing. And we got in somebody who had expressed an interest. And we took most of a session bringing him up to speed on what had actually happened. I mean, this was in character, but even so, it was a surprising amount that you need to know in order to participate in the game at that point.
Yeah, there is a case for saying just let them flounder. They're the new guy in the team, and they've been brought in, and
there was a certain amount of that, but this is somebody who already knew actual World War II history and needed to be told how it was now different.
Oh, that, yes, I forgot you were doing, by the midpoint of your game, you were doing a wildly variant.
I don't know about wildly. I mean, the actual history continued to be useful all the way through, but there were bits of it that were quite different behind the scenes.
Yeah, I love my players and I love my note takers, but Jenny Southern has a habit of saying to me in my Banestorm games that bringing up throwaway characters which I used once in a game decades before and expecting me to remember them as well as she does. And that is deeply embarrassing for me. My ability to improvise stuff is something I rely on and I enjoy deeply, but it don't stick. It don't stick at all. And this is a problem.
I suppose one must consider it a compliment.
Yes, definitely. I wonder if J.K. Rowling gets annoyed with her fans when they bring up the inconsistency in book one that she hadn't noticed when she wrote book seven. Or something like that. I expect she can afford to avoid that sort of encounter nowadays.
Well, by book three, she had outgrown any editor's ability to actually fix her prose anyway, so...
I enjoyed a whole series. I may have arguments with her politics, but not with her craftsmanship.
I read many of the things that she stole it from, so I'm less impressed with the craftsmanship. But anyway, this is irrelevant. The interval between games is a consideration, definitely.
It's an immense problem.
More generally, how much the players have been doing in between.
If they
are doing other stuff, you know, nobody seems to have a really good definition for blue booking, but you know, game related stuff that happens outside the game. In a very broad sense. This is something that's been happening with Watson Hall. We have a potentially large campaign that we're gearing up for at the moment, and we have been chatting a lot about it and sorting out characters and discussing bits of background detail and explaining why relativity says that you cannot, in fact, put a maximum speed on a reactionless drive because then you have to have a privileged reference frame to define that speed in, and so on. Planet Killers are not part of this setting.
Yeah, okay, you have players for whom that makes sense. I get players who tell me, no, magic doesn't work that way, when I'm the one who's setting up the bloody universe.
It was very noticeable running 2300 in a section where I mentioned that here is something of broadly stellar mass, but clearly way higher density than an actual star would be. And some players instantly leap to Chandrasekhar limit and some players don't.
My character should know that, but I don't. I was going to say that I've only ever tried to use it once, which was using a wiki to sustain and expand the setting background. It's a lovely tool if you can do it, and if you've got the discipline to actually shift stuff into the wiki once it's happened and set and is part of the background. You can potentially allow players access to it to not just to read, but to edit it. And it's something I should do more of. I should definitely do more of for my current setting, which has gone through several iterations and has accumulated lore in different periods of the setting.
It's very tricky. I mean, my notes for a session, even a four-hour convention game session, tend to be a side of A4, maybe two. And that is really not enough to run an adventure from for anybody else. Friend of the show, Shimon Beck, has started from some of these and turned them into something approximating an actual runnable adventure. And goodness, they are much longer. And only some of that is because I can say that dodgy shop by the church and know what I'm talking about. Whereas to somebody else, I would have to explain in detail.
Well, my not only is my memory wonky, and I can come across something which I've written down, which is doubtless meant a whole lot at the time, but doesn't spark anything now. And that's just assuming that my terrible handwriting, which is the other problem, that my terrible handwriting is allowing me to read it in the first place.
Are you sure you wrote it? You could develop a whole full-blown paranoia here if you work at it.
But the evidence that I may have a secondary personality with the same terrible handwriting is just too horrible to contemplate. Taking out my iPad and tapping out a few lines of legible stuff, which may turn out to be nonsense later, but is just too big a break in the flow of the adventure. It's just a too long a time for my attention to be away from feeding the players new stuff.
Yep, even though I do much more typing than I do writing, I have found that taking notes in as written text works much better for me, as you say, because it's less of a distraction from the actual adventure. Very often it's a marginal note on my running sheet.
Yeah.
This guy is now dead or whatever.
That sort of note can be comprehensible. I don't know if voice dictation would work, theoretically. I should probably try it sometime.
It's extremely variable by person, is my experience. I've known one person who tried a variety of systems. She had a quite standard educated voice of the 40s and 50s, and the system simply could not be trained to cope with that.
The Scotsman in the lift.
But anyway.
Do you have a good voice for AI?
I wouldn't wish to know.
Quite. But I think I ought to try that sometime and to see if it will produce usable notes, which I can use to update. As I say, it takes me a week or so to write up one evening's session.
This is not ideal if you're running two sessions in a week.
This is true, and this is why I don't do it. I've thought of feeding that to a voice recognition program, and I really should make that experiment sometime soon. But and that would speed up immensely my transcript and my burden with the ENA, because it's just too much. I don't know if the quality of my recording is going to be good enough for the device, for the program, to separate out what people are doing. But it might be, and I should make the experiment.
This is a hidden benefit of online games, of course. If you record them the right way, you can get each person's voice on a separate channel, which really cuts down on the whole people speaking over each other problem.
Ah, technicality. You'd have to have a paid service to do that.
Don't.
Right, all right. So Roger is the one you should send all your queries to.
I put some notes on this on the discussion to KDB forum where somebody else was asking about it.
Okay. In that case, that will go into the show notes and save you all a lot of time. We hope that you are doing interesting things with your own precious time, which you managed to squeeze for your hobby away from your bustling lives. Please tell us about it.
Yeah, the main thing I would say here is if you find that it's being a burden to GM the same thing every week, don't do that. The game does not have to be every week. There can be breaks. There can be somebody else takes over for a bit, maybe runs something else. I have burned out as a GM several times. It's not nice. I try not to do it again.
Yeah, it is not nice. I don't know that... I think my players look at me with relief when I say I'm willing to do something. They also looked at me with some concern yesterday when I said that next week, because of player absences, I was going to run one of the odd role-playing games that I collect and never otherwise get to run. And they looked at me with long-suffering, worthy of a spouse, and said, all right, Michael, all right, but really... I just don't know when I'm abusing my privileges. I'm still going to go on and do it.
So in this game, you're all playing monads.
You cannot communicate with anybody else, but the universe still changes around you, nonetheless. And now we've got to put a bloody reference to Leibniz into the footnotes. See what you've done, Roger. See what you've done. Oh, dear. I think there may be more tedious philosophers. I mean, doubtless a great mathematician. There may be more tedious philosophers than Leibniz, but it would be a bit of a struggle. Maybe Kant. Now I've got to put a footnote to him in. Oh, damn. Let's stop this before it gets out of hand. So, as I was saying, do let us know about your frequency and whether you could use a rest, and what social structures you find yourself embedded in, and whether you enjoy it or not. You can contact us via...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
And we will be back, possibly getting into the blaze of summer, next month.